All right, colleagues, it is 9:30. I think let us be going. Good morning to the colleagues, Advocate Mutibi and your team from the SIU.
Good morning, Chair.
The AG, Bob Makwete, and your team, good morning. Colleagues, I think we are going to just immediately jump into it because we are pressed for time, as indicated earlier on, particularly because there's the mini budget this afternoon, which in itself is something that this committee will have to pay particular attention to. And so I think members will have to ready themselves. Having said that, it does not mean we're going to paper over the issues and just, for lack of a better term, to use a Zulu phrase, asizukunyanyalata. We'll do everything that needs to be done, but we will be conscious of time. Colleagues, this morning we are dealing with the issues around the UIF ahead of our visit to the UIF head offices on Friday. To get a sense of what is actually going on and the progress in that regard of the issues we had raised when we met with the UIF in June, particularly around the areas of corruption, the shortcomings in their systems insofar as payments and transfers were concerned. And we, of course, have subsequently learned that the Minister of Employment and Labour has, amongst other things, suspended the commissioner at the UIF, whom we had the opportunity, I think that's the word, to interact with at our last meeting. And I think things were as clear then as they are now, that the UIF was characterised by heightened confusion, and just a lot of difficulties. colleagues, I would like to, before we dive into it, we will start with the SIU and then go to the AG. But I think it is opportune at the very outset of the meeting, as this may well be our last engagement with the Auditor General, Babu Makwete, to convey our grandest and greatest salutations to him and thank him for being a role model public servant in the Office of Auditor General, an office which I believe he has conducted himself with the highest level of professionalism, befitting the office, and dedication and commitment, and has always been readily available to interact and engage with this committee and to give us the necessary advice and guidance, whether it's been in this parliament or the previous one. And I think I speak for all colleagues when I thank him for all that he has done and wish him well for his future endeavors, as he will of course be exploring new avenues, and hope that he will not be lost to us and to South Africa as a source of information, guidance, and to always offer his views and in matters of the cause of work that we do. To borrow a biblical phrase, I can only say, well done, good and faithful servant. So, Baba Makwete, sibongakhulu baba. Thank you very much. We will continue to borrow from your work. I will give colleagues an opportunity later on to convey and express themselves accordingly, but I thought that at the outset of the meeting, let me just make those few remarks. Colleagues, welcome to the meeting. Sistombi Putben, please enter the apologies into the record and then we'll dive right into it. Advocate Mutibi will hand over to you, and then we're going to go to the AG, and then we'll take questions because the issues are one and the same. HOU, over to you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Auditor General, the colleagues from AG, and my colleagues from SIU. We'll go right into it, Honorable Chair. I will introduce the presentation, and then my colleague, Mr. Leroux, who is the lead investigator, will proceed with the presentation. I'm joined by Mr. Leroux and by Mr. Lekgetho in the presentation. So if I start off, I can't see the presentation now. Thank you. If you can do the slideshow, it will help. Thank you. Go to the second slide. Right. As an introduction, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, this matter relating to the Unemployment Insurance Fund was referred to the SIU by the Minister of Employment and Labour, indicating that there were allegations relating to irregularities on the Unemployment Insurance Fund. We, of course, received the allegations, and we were also provided with the copy of the Auditor General's report from the Minister's office. And we obviously went through the report. Our determination, having gone through the report, was that there was a procurement process. Of course, at the time we had the Proclamation 23 of 2020, which focuses on the COVID-19 irregularities, alleged corruption. So we tested the allegations against the proclamation and saw whether it falls within the scope. There was one area which we determined that falls within the scope of the proclamation, which was the area around the procurement of the awareness campaign. However, we didn't end there. If you go to the next slide. So we now entered into a secondment agreement, because this secondment agreement would enable us to look into all those matters that at the time do not fall within the scope of the proclamation. So as we say in the slides, we entered into the agreement, secondment agreement with the Department of Employment and Labour to obtain further evidence so that we can do a motivation for the amendment of the current proclamation. That process is underway, but of course we at the same time still doing our investigation under the secondment agreement. It's an effective manner of doing an investigation while we are processing the proclamation, and that is provided for in our legislation. Now, as we do during any investigation, whether it's under the secondment or proclamation, our focus is to do an effective investigation and bring out the legal outcomes that we always do, be it disciplinary action, criminal action, or civil recovery. Amongst others, we will also look at the systemic recommendations that we can do, because we also look at what could have failed, if there's any systems failure, people failure. We then point that out so that improvements can be made as we complete our investigation to mitigate possible maladministration and corruption going forward. The secondment agreement that we entered into will end on the 15th of December. Hopefully by that time we would have processed the proclamation amendment so that we can now proceed. Now, today's presentation, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, covers matters that we investigated under the proclamation and those that we are investigating under the secondment agreement. And we will take the committee now through those two parts of our investigation. If we turn over the page, with your permission, Honorable Chair, this is where I hand over to my colleague, Mr. Johnny Leroux. Mr. Leroux, over to you, please.
That's fine, HOU, you can delegate as you deem fit until you you are done, so you don't have to, so we can manage our time, no problem.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Advocate Nkibi, and I want to greet the chairperson of SCOPA and the honourable members. I'm grateful for the opportunity to present this investigation to SCOPA. So what we are looking at is currently firstly starting off with matters covered under the proclamation being R23 of 2020. So the awareness campaign is what we started with, and that's the matter that falls within the proclamation R23. The AG's findings suggested that no proper SCM process was followed to appoint at least five companies for the awareness campaign, and that the appointments were made based on the motivation for sole service providers. The SIU commenced its investigation into the matter on the 24th of August 2020. That's after receiving the Auditor General's findings, and the value of the five contracts amount to 6.1 million rand. We are now going into the service providers, and these are the RFQs that were put out and the respective values. It was for radio advertising on RFQ 2658 for 184,000 rand, RFQ 256 for 899,256 rand and 30 cents, an advertising campaign for 1,290,300 rand, advertising campaign again for 877,680 rand, and then campaign RFQ 2654 for 2,892,540 rand and 38 cents, which then brings us to a total of 6,144,351 rand and 68 cents. These five service providers were required to conduct advertising campaigns in order to create awareness about the UIF COVID-19 TERS for the duration of 45 seconds for three spots per day for 4 weeks on their respective radio channels and related television channels. The UIF's BAC requested for a deviation from the normal procurement process in order to appoint the service providers. All the service providers were appointed on a deviation. The SIU is conducting a full-scale investigation in order to confirm and or refute corruption, maladministration allegations, and or to determine if there were any undue benefits or gratification paid to the UIF officials to influence the process of the SCM. The investigation includes the following. The SIU reviewed all the SCM-related documents, which included all the related contracts and invoices. The SIU reviewed all the relevant minutes and audio recordings of the two VAC meetings relating to these appointments. We interviewed all the key UIF officials that dealt with the SCM process, and we obtained 14 affidavits from several UIF officials. Moving along, the team interviewed the identified company directors related to the five service providers and obtained their affidavits of some of them. The team is in the process of reviewing personnel files, emails, and additional information or evidence. Furthermore, the team is conducting a financial profile of specific UIF officials and identified service providers. A sequence of events timeline was prepared for each of the five service providers, highlighting the irregular SCM processes. We interviewed a representative of the Independent Communication Authority of South Africa, in inverted commas, ICASA, who provided an affidavit and relevant information. And we interviewed one official from the GCIS, the Government Communication and Information Systems, regarding similar requests from state institutions in the past. Progress to date. Most radio and television advertising from all government departments are usually done through the GCIS. The UIF did not contact GCIS due to the alleged urgency of the awareness campaign. One official from SEM assumed the request for quotation to be an emergency and the specifications were provided. The SEM department failed to source service providers on behalf of the communications and marketing department. The communication and marketing department conceded that the problem was with the interpretation of the term sole service provider and acknowledged that the appointments were irregular. The BAC requested for deviation from the normal SEM process to appoint these five service providers. One BAC member that we interviewed stated that he signed for a recommendation for the SABC to be the only entity to broadcast the awareness campaign since the SABC accommodated 11 South African languages, or all South African languages. This initiative was allegedly going to save the UIF money and time. However, he was overruled. The team is in the process of verifying this information with the audio recordings of the two BAC meetings. ICASA provided a list of all commercial radio stations and television channels, and they are 27 commercial radio stations, 16 public radio stations, 9 commercial television channels, 3 public channels, and 70 community radio stations. The five service providers were appointed without following the proper SEM process. Where relevant, practice note number 8 of 2007 and 8 requires that for all procurement of goods and services not exceeding 500,000, at least 3 quotations must be obtained. This was not followed as it was motivated that the 5 companies were sole service providers. These appointments were not in compliance with section 217 in brackets 1 of the Constitution and section 51 in brackets 1A3 of the PFMA. The UIF acted unlawfully because there were other commercial radio stations registered with ICASA in those provinces. Furthermore, the SABC was able to deliver the same message through 11 languages. The communication and marketing department misrepresented to the BAC that the service providers were sole source service providers, and the misrepresentation caused the UIF actual prejudice. One SEM official failed in her duties when she allowed the marketing and communications department to predetermine the names of the service providers on the specifications. This failure resulted in an irregular expenditure of the UIF. The recommendations, approval, appointments, and the payments of these service providers were in contravention of Section 51A3. Of the Public Finance Management Act. Now we move over to the type of outcomes that we are expecting, disciplinary referrals. The team is in the process to finalize the evidence packs against 14 UIF officials. Under criminal referrals will be determined subsequent to the review of the emails, personnel file, and the financial information which involves the profiling. Civil litigation. Appropriate litigation will be considered by the SIT. Now we are moving over to matters investigated under the secondment agreement. So the secondment agreement, based on the key audit observations made by the AGSA, a secondment agreement dated 5 September 2020 between the Department of Employment and Labour and the SIU was entered into. Temporary Employment Relief Scheme benefit. The Auditor General of South Africa made a commitment to the President to assist government in dealing with the financial management risks posed by the emergency measures taken due to the outbreak of the global coronavirus pandemic. Based on the aforementioned and as part of their interim audit, their focus was on 1. COVID-19 related account balances and classes of transactions and compliance with key legislation applicable to the COVID-19 related transactions, funds, and processes. The COVID-19 TERS benefit is an intervention by the Department of Employment and Labour through the Unemployment Insurance Fund to compensate employees that find themselves temporarily unemployed during the lockdown period due to the national disaster caused by COVID-19. The following slide deals with the key audit observations made by the AGSA. There are exactly 30 that have been identified by the SIU. Its ID number is the same as the UIF employees. Deceased individuals paid TERS benefits. Individuals who are imprisoned were paid benefits. Double dipping, bank details same as the UIF employees. Individuals sharing banking details. Individuals with invalid ID numbers. Double dipping within the UIF. Payments above the maximum threshold. Overpayments, underpayments, duplicate payments, unsubstantiated payments made, unsubstantiated applications made, payments to foreign nationals, applicants that are below the legal age of employment, lack of consideration of salary portion paid by employer in the calculation of payouts for first lockdown period, lack of verification of employee salary submitted during the benefit claims, claims with an application date after the payment date, employer verifications, claims with no application date or approval date, fraud risks related to the manual application process, fraud risks related to the manual and online application process, incorrect system calculations of the TERS benefit payment for the first lockdown period, inadequate controls to verify employer details, lack of controls to verify of applicants representing employers, inadequate system functionality to utilize bank confirmation uploaded on the system to verify banking details, non-compliance with the instruction note, discrepancies relating to the appointment of service providers, and unfair award of contracts. The secondment agreement dated 5 September 2020 stated that the team of secondees will focus on the following as an interim. So what we did is we focused on government employees with personnel numbers claiming from the fund, SANDF staff claiming from the fund, inmates claiming from the fund, UIF employees claiming from the relief fund, excessive amounts claimed by individuals and or companies, incorrect system calculations, duplicate payments to beneficiaries, and individuals who are on SASSA grants like old age and disability grants claiming from the fund. Now we're dealing with the UIF data. The secondment team initially experienced challenges with regards to the data from the UIF due to incompatibility with the SIU's databases and systems. To alleviate this problem, the team relied on the data provided by the AGSA used during their audit process. Status of the secondment investigation. The team obtained a high-level understanding of some of the processes adopted by the UIF relevant to the TERS benefit. The team interviewed several officials from the UIF. The team collected valuable information, which at this stage is untested and are currently being tested. To date, the secondment team analyzed the data from the AGSA and based on the key audit observations made by the AGSA, decided to concentrate on the following aspects. The SANDF staff who claim from the relief fund. The SANDF staff represent 78 exceptions amounting to 327,638 rand relating to the TERS benefit paid to the individuals linked to the SANDF employment. A total of 59 SANDF members associated to 55 bank accounts were identified. Furthermore, three bank accounts have multiple beneficiaries and four SANDF members have multiple bank accounts. Inmates claiming from the fund, seven DCS inmates were identified to be claiming from the relief fund to a total of 40,657 rand and 93 cents. Then we had deceased individuals who were paid TERS benefits totaling to 441,144 rand and 34 cents, which represents 68 deceased beneficiaries making use of 72 bank accounts. Furthermore, two bank accounts depicted multiple beneficiaries and seven deceased beneficiaries had multiple bank accounts. Government officials claiming from the fund. 6,140 officials were identified claiming from the fund, totaling 41 million and 9,737 rand and 70 cents, making use of 3,959 bank accounts. Of the 3,959 bank accounts identified, 581 accounts were associated to multiple beneficiaries, to 3,079 beneficiaries. 55 beneficiaries were identified with no bank accounts, amounting to 301,124.19. So the status of the secondment investigation, based on the aforementioned, the team prepared letters to the following institutions requesting specific details on the key audit observations made by the AGSA. So we prepared letters to the SANDF, DCS and the Department of Home Affairs to confirm the status of the ID numbers, and that would include all three departments, such as ID numbers, are they still employed, etc. These letters were delivered to the aforementioned institutions for action on the 23rd of October, 2020. The SIU was alerted on the 22nd of October that 11 suspects were arrested relating to fraud perpetrated against the UIF. The information as depicted in the following slide shows arrests made by the Hawks. The SIU is in the process of applying for the extension of the current COVID-19 proclamation in order to investigate all TERS matters, which are worth an estimated value of 985 million rand. Here, the chair can see, and honorable members can see the case numbers, the police station where those case numbers are registered, the company names which were then regarded as suspects in the matter, the potential value, the amount recovered by the UIF, and the last column is the number of arrests. So the first is the mega bus and coach. Claimed 4,804,834.65, and of that, the UIF recovered 4,705,205.78. CSG Resourcing Pty Limit claimed 5,689,377.60. Nothing has been recovered, but five suspects have been arrested. National Adhesive Distributor CC UIF reference, 692,185.55 were claimed, of which three suspects were arrested. Mutiti dropped in center, 3,166,498 rand, one suspect arrested, and then KBAC Flooring Pty Limit claimed 128,878.40 and one suspect arrested. That is a total of 14,481,774.20 that were claimed, and a recovery of, as I said previously, the 4.7 million, with a total of 11 suspects arrested, and the SIU is obviously monitoring these matters. Then, cases currently under investigation by the Special Commercial Crimes Unit in Pretoria, a total of 70 criminal cases were registered with the SAPS and are currently under investigation. No arrests have been made in relation to these matters. The total value of all the 70 matters amount to 1,490,436.15. The SIU is working together with other law enforcement agencies and the Fusion Hub to deal with these matters. I thank you. I hand over to you, Advocate Matibi. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leroux. Honorable Chair, honorable members, although there has been some outcomes reached, the investigation is ongoing, and we are hoping to further uncover any of the irregularities or possible corruption that could have been committed. To date, there is a clear indication that at the UIF, there was a failure of people, process, and systems. And this requires an urgent attention. We have read, the minister is on record saying that the UIF is attending to these processes. We are heartened that SCOPA will be conducting a site visit so that they could monitor the UIF. So we look forward to even producing further legal outcomes and the systemic recommendations so that the maladministration and the corruption that is endemic there could be rooted out, mitigated, and prevented going forward. Thank you very much, Chair. We appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, thank you very much, HOU. Well, quite clearly, all that you have said is a vindication for us as this committee, because we pointed to these challenges when we last met with the UIF, and when we pointed to them, they tried to, explain themselves in a manner which was not satisfactory. And I was reminded of the saying, the lady don't protest too much meetings, and I think I can quite succinctly adapt it to say I thought then, as I do now, that the commissioner don't protest too much. Right, colleagues, we will hand over to the AG, and then we will field questions on both, because the matters are somewhat interrelated. Magwetu, over to you and your team.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to all the members present. Chair, just as an introductory comment, I think all members will recall that on the 2nd of September, we released our first report on the COVID-19 expenditure, covering, among others, the UIF. At that point, the actual expenditure was somewhere around 41 billion up to that point. It is pleasing to note, Chair, that the matters that were surfaced from that report are already receiving attention, as we had looked at the presentation from the colleagues at the SIU. We'd like to commend them for taking those urgent steps to make sure that the matters that were in our report do not fester, but do get taken to the next level, including by the rest of the colleagues in the Fusion Center. Having listened to the presentation from the SIU colleagues, Chair, the rest of the work that we are doing now, which we are hoping to report in our second report by the end of November, is going to largely contain matters based on the follow-up work, including other work that we would have done as an audit office for the period after July 2020 to date. So on that note, Chair, and I'm hoping that Sibongile, my colleague who's going to be running the presentation, will take the cue from the colleague's presentation of the SIU and cover those areas that have not already been emphasized in their presentation. I know I'm trying my luck here, but I'm sure she will adapt based on what has been presented and give you a sense of where are we. But I have a sense that the bulk of the issues that will preoccupy our mind are what has been done in the period subsequent to our report. Let me hand over to Sibongi, the Chair, who is the lead executive on this portfolio, and she will take the committee through what we have prepared on our side. Sibongi, please. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members, and thank you, AG, for the opportunity to present. I also did note that most of the findings were covered by the SIU colleagues that just gave the presentation. So I'll try to just expand on ones where I feel that maybe additional information could be useful to the members. AG has already started talking about the work that we're doing that would inform the SR2 report that we'll be tabling shortly. But in the main, maybe just give a sense of where we are right now. So we are obviously there at UIF doing the work that would inform the findings for the SR2. In the main, it's the follow-up work. So we have engaged with UIF and they've given us a sense of where they are with implementing the action plans they've committed to. We have audited the majority of them. We are currently just in the state of engaging with them and discussing some of the observations that we have so that we could finalize on that front. But also we have analyzed the data up to September, and you would note that most of those actions would have been implemented in September. So there are some of the findings that would still come up as exception, and purely because UIF will not have responded to the gaps that we've flagged initially. And we'll also test the payments that we've made subsequent to the changes being made so that we could get a sense of whether those changes are effective or not. So I won't spend a lot of time on the background. I think if you could just move to slide 8 so that we could just start getting into the findings. And I think, it, as I've noted, the ones where SIU has covered, I'll just go through them quite quickly. So the first one there, so what we've done, we've categorized the findings into 4 sections. The one was where we were just understanding the systems at UIF based from both from the process perspective, but also in terms of how the system was configured. And we have observations around that. And the second part would be data analytics. And what we've done around the data analytics is we did get the information from UIF, the data, from the application process right up to the payment process. And we've analyzed that data to pick up the gap. But in addition to that, we've used different databases from government to help us in our analysis. So the first one that I just want to talk to is that there we were raising 3 points, really, and it was around the verification of the individuals that are representing employers in the application process. So we were saying that the system at UIF was not necessarily prohibiting a single person to represent a multiple of employers or bargaining council. So you'll find that one person is putting applications on behalf of multiple employers or bargaining councils. But secondly, that the UIF were not necessarily having processes in place to verify that this person representing the employers is duly authorized to submit the application on their behalf. And thirdly, that the information, the input data that was being presented by this individual representing the employers was not verified, which obviously does mean that the adequate preventative controls in place around that area to ensure that when somebody is submitting an invalid claim or they are purporting to be representing someone, that is being picked up so that it can be dealt with appropriately. The second part, I think the SIU colleagues have spoken to it, so I won't dwell into it. We were saying that in the first lockdown period, to the 27th to the 30th of April, the system had a standardized number of days, which was about 35 days. And when they were calculating the payment itself, they would use this standard period, and they would not necessarily look at the actual claim, the number of days that are included in the actual claim, which resulted in overpayment in a lot of instances. The next one, which talks to the inadequate verification of employer details, which is on the next slide, what we were flagging there were really the risk around the lack of adequate processes to verify the claims that are being submitted. What the UIF system was able to do was to use the UIF reference number as a means of verifying the validity of this employer. But we're saying that there are other areas that could have been looked at to verify, like your CICP information, telephone numbers, and all of that. And what that would have prevented really was to ensure that all the employers that are submitting claim are actually companies that are registered and that are actually doing business, conducting business. It would have actually just helped to prevent non-existing companies from applying. The next one, which is number 4, at a high level was bank confirmation. What we had observed is that as part of the documents that UIF had requested, one of those documents was a bank confirmation, which the intention was that would be proof that the bank account you're listing there is valid and it belongs to that company. But what we observed was that they didn't have checks and balances in place to ensure that before payment is made, they are comparing the bank account to which they are making the payment to the document, the bank confirmation, make sure that you are paying the the right person and you're paying it to the correct bank account, which was a flaw in the system, because you might end up paying to incorrect bank accounts and it becomes difficult to recover the funds later on. I'll also move to the next one on number five. And most of this is just risk that we're flagging where it could potentially result in overpayment being made. On this one, what we're saying is during the first lockdown, some of the employers would have paid a portion of the salary and they were submitting a claim to the UIF for the portion that they were not going to cover. But the UIF system did not take the part that the employer was paying into account when they were calculating the benefits to pass through to the individual. And in some instances, what that resulted to is that the employee would end up getting paid more than the salary, which was not the intention. So we're flagging that, which we picked up from the first lockdown. Number six, the observation that we're making is that UIF did not have preventative controls. If you take a step back, you'll have the employees who would have been registered by the fund. And obviously on month-to-month basis, the employer will declare the employees, but also together with their salaries. And that was obviously used to calculate the fee that gets paid to UIF. But during the test benefit, UIF did not have a process of checking whether the salary that the employer is declaring is aligned to what they've been declaring all along, which was the basis of insuring these employees. So that verification was not done. And obviously the risk there is that some employers might claim that an individual is earning more than what they actually would actually earn, so that they could get a higher benefit. So that observation was made there. And that maybe at a high level sums up some of the preventative controls that we're saying that there are gaps in the system, and we had obviously asked UIF to cover them. The next section, a bulk of it would be covered by the colleagues from the SIU, because the next observations are around the data analytics themselves. And I will just go through the ones they didn't cover. I would move through the slides quite quickly. I think the first one, what we've done is we obviously took all the data of all the individuals that have been paid, and we analyzed it and compared it to the Home Affairs database. And what we picked up was there were individuals that were below the legal employment age of 15 that were paid by the fund as part of the tariff benefit. The number eight, as SIU has covered, which is the identity ID number that we've picked up belonging to, that is the same as the employee of the UIF. So I would not dwell into that. And number nine on slide number 12 is talking to payments that were made, tariff payments that were made to individuals that are deceased according to Home Affairs. And I think the colleagues have covered that. We're also going to jump the imprisoned individuals because they've already given the details of that. I would want to move to slide 13, number 12, which is the payments to foreign nationals. So the observation we've made there, which would be on this next slide, is that number 12 there. What we have done there is we do understand that UIF has made payments to employees who are foreign nationals. And we do accept that obviously where these employees were covered by the fund previously, then the fund can rightfully pay them. What we have observed there is that as part of the payment, so two things, that one is UIF did make payments to employees, foreign national employees that have not contributed to the fund for the past 12 months. So basically, employees that were not previously registered by the fund. But secondly, that UIF did not necessarily confirm whether these employees either were having valid work permits or were refugees, basically saying they are legally in the country and they can work. And I know that as part of the response UIF has indicated that this is an area that they will continue to pay. But what we're flagging is that obviously we need to reflect and look at what was the intention for making this payment and how do we make sure that we respond to the risk that some of these claims might not be valid claims. If you think about the South African citizens, we're able to take their ID numbers and check against the Home Affairs database and see whether this is a valid ID. But obviously with the foreign nationals, especially if you can't find them in the Home Affairs database, then there are challenges around that, which could point sort of increase the risk around invalid claims being made. So I think we're highlighting that. And what we're suggesting or recommending is that this should be investigated to look at whether these claims were legitimate, valid claims that the UIF intended to pay. And obviously where there are invalid claims that came through, that needs to be looked at.
You are muted. If you can just unmute yourself and then retrace yourself to about 15 seconds ago.
Okay, sorry, I don't know what happened there. I had closed the foreign nationals here. I'm hoping you could still hear me there. And I was moving to...
Okay, carry on, that's fine.
Okay, and I was moving to the next slide, Chair, indicating that the findings on the next slide would have covered, would have been covered by SIU in terms of the individual sharing the banking, same banking details, and also the double dipping within the UIF. So I will not dwell into those ones. I will move to... I will move to maybe if I could just make a point on number 13 on the slide, Chair. So I do note that the SIU colleagues are looking into this double dipping, especially the SNDF and the government employees, and also the SASSA employees. Maybe the point that I just wanted to make around the NEFAS is obviously when we did the analysis, we flagged the students who are who are paid from the TERS benefit, but at the same time, they are receiving stipends from NEFSA. And what we were saying there is that obviously as government, we need to reflect on what was the intention of us agreeing to pay this TERS benefit, which was obviously to provide relief to the employees. But if you look at, was it the intention of this scheme to allow an individual to benefit from two government funding, one being the NEFSA stipend and the other one being obviously the TERS benefit from UIF. And that's something we need to, that government has to reflect on it and oversight reflect on it, because I do know that that is one of the areas that UIF has said they will continue to pay it, because obviously there isn't really a law that prohibits them, anything that prohibits them from paying it. And we were just, it's something that we're asking that the leadership from UIF and obviously oversight reflect on it going forward. I would maybe move to I think the others have been covered by the SIU colleagues. I'll move to slide 18 and I'll look there on some of the areas we've picked up on the payments which the colleagues haven't covered. On slide 18, number 21, they were talking about unsubstantiated payments that have been made. And what we've done there, Chair, is you have two systems. You have one, the application system that processed when the individual, from the starting point when the claim has been submitted to the UIF up to when it is approved. You also have another system where it is the payment system. So what we've looked at, what we've done is we've tried to reconcile the two systems to look at whether all the TERS payments that have been made, were they approved from the application system, just to confirm that every payment that has been processed is supported by an approved application that has been taken through all the processes, and we're saying those are transactions we couldn't reconcile. So we have about 7 transactions that we couldn't reconcile. And then on the number 22, we're saying that the application system did not have invoice numbers. And what that means is that we could not necessarily trace that to the payments to make sure that they have been paid. So because of the lack of the invoice, or the one thing that links the application system to the payment system, then we were able to conclude on that. And we've asked that UIF perform the reconciliation of the transactions between the application system to what has been paid to ensure that they aren't, one, applications that have been approved but have not been paid, but two, that all the applications that have been paid are supported by an approved transaction. On number 23, which is the next slide, that has been covered, we have picked up payments that have been made. The payment date is before the application date, which ordinarily should not necessarily happen. So we flagged that, and I know the SIU colleagues have covered it. On slide 20 deals with the SCM issues, observations, and those have been adequately covered in the SIU presentation. I would not necessarily dwell on them a lot. The last, the slide 21, there we were flagging some of the fraud risk. And if you just reflect on this fraud risk a bit, you'll see that these are some of the risks we've highlighted, and the observations we've made is an indication that some of this risk have actually materialized, because we were talking about the lack of independent review and reconciliation. And you'll see that some of the recommendations we were making was that reconciliations have to be performed. We also talked about the lack of segregation of duties, where obviously the lack of segregation of duties is there to make sure that you're separating the processes, that if there are challenges or there are gaps or there are issues that needs to be flagged on this claim, they are flagged. So I think that would be part of the things that have compromised the UIF from the processes perspective. So I think that will talk to the fraud risk. The last slide really is we did select employers that we wanted to visit to do a few things. One is to verify whether that employer exists, but secondly, to confirm some of the declarations that would have been made by these employers in their submission to the UAM. When we finalized the first SR, we had visited a few of them, and we committed to finishing the visits in the SR2. But on the few that we've done before we finalized the SR1, we already confirmed that there's one that we picked up where by the time we got to the address that they'd indicated in the application, the premises were really deserted, and it didn't look like there was a company there, so we couldn't do the test, which was a risk for us. It was just flagging the risk from the validity of the claim. And obviously, one of the other observations is that even though we have tried to organize this visit in time, we had instances when we got there, we couldn't access the employer's premises because they indicated that they were not sufficiently prepared for the audit, which could also be just a risk indicator. Because if you have submitted these claims about 2-3 months ago, they should be easily accessible and should be able to easily access the information to help us with the audit. And AG, on the last slide, the conclusion, I think AG had already mentioned that some of the recommendations we've made in terms of the way forward, especially we were talking about making sure that there are stringent preventative controls implemented to minimize the risk of fraud and error. But we've seen that there are actions that are being implemented to improve the system and also improve just the processes. We're also talking about investigation, and I think the presentation earlier did give us a sense that that is happening. So this slide, what is here in the slide, was more to recommend to the UIF that let's make sure that we focus on the preventative controls that would help us avoid the risk of fraud and error, but two, that we design detective controls that will help us pick up if there are errors that have been missed in the verification process. And the last one is obviously instituting investigation to try and recover the funds from obviously the individuals that were not meant to receive the claim. So I think in the nutshell, that's how the findings that I took you through, Chair. If there is a specific finding where you would like more detail, I'm happy to deal with it. But also to close, I think I'll link it back to the comments AG that has made around the work we're doing with now the SR2 in the main following up on the actions that have been made by the UIF, but also continuing to analyze the payment up until the 30th of September, and try and split that into two. Obviously, one would be before the UIF implemented the actions to respond to our findings, and then the other area would be where the actions have been implemented. That will give us a sense whether the actions implemented are effective or not. So I'll hand it back to AG Chair. Thanks, AG.
Right, thanks very much, Sibongile. Thank you, Chair. I think Sibongile has summarized the way forward, but I think I'd like to reinforce the point about the preventative controls. I think it's part of what we take away from this, that the UIF and many other funds, including programs, are ongoing activities that government carries out every month, every year. And there's no better set of controls than those that prevent some of these things from happening so that we don't have to worry about the follow-up activities afterwards. So we'd like to flag that point while all of the other activities are taking place via the Fusion Center. We do want to put a stick on the ground for SCOPA to say that the preventative control approach needs to be something that we embrace into the future because it will give us an elaborate set of insights into what is going wrong before we lose the money. Back to you, Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. No, thank you very much, AG. All right. I think that too is a further vindication really of our well-held fears about the control deficiencies which characterize the UIF and were quite prevalent and clear for us to see when we interacted with the UIF. So none of what has been presented to us today, either by the SIU or the AG, comes as a surprise. Safe to say, of course, we remain fundamentally disappointed and concerned at the fact that systems continue to, you know, flounder in the manner in which they are at the UIF. And it's clear that failing to plan is planning to fail. The kind of eventualities that we have arrived at because of COVID-19, whilst they may not have been anticipated in the scenario planning of every government department or entity, and the corporation really should factor in the kind of forecasting that there may be a disaster of this magnitude at any point. So thank you very much, AG and the SIU. I'm going to now hand over to colleagues, and I see that Honorable Lisa is the first one off the bat. Mazamban, over to you, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me start by congratulating you on your collar and tie. It looks very impressive.
I'm inspired, Chairman, by you, Mazamban.
Mr. Chairman, thank you to both units for the good work they are doing on this project, for want of another word. It's what I have come to expect of Kimmy over many years, and so thank you to you, Kimmy, for the work you've done. None of us are perfect, and I have at times been critical, but there cannot be any real negative aspersions about your time in office. So thank you very much for that. Mr. Chairman, one of the difficulties, not difficulties, but one of the things I think we must be careful of is assuming that this process, this completely abnormal process involving TERS in particular, is going to continue indefinitely or be repeated. I think this is a once-off, and the emphasis really, and I think it is, should be on ensuring that those who have defrauded the system repay the money and go to jail, as opposed to signing a whole, or try to perfect the system, which will never be used again. So I think that is something we've got to be cautious about, pouring resources into designing a system which has seen the end of, or is coming to the end of its life in any event. However, the point that you make succinctly, and many of us have had to work with UIF and the Compensation Commissioner for that matter for years and decades, have experienced the lack of proper systems, professionalism in those departments. And of course the TERS system is simply the flaws in this TERS system is simply a reflection of the general malaise which bugs the UIF, from the call center to all sorts of things, even the submission of monthly returns for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been almost impossible to do so online. And so people have either just not paid, or they've been forced to go and stand in long queues at labor centers and try and do it manually and get a rubber stamp on the receipt. It's just a nightmare. And so, as you say, quite rightly, it's really no surprise that the system used for the TERS payments had so many flaws, which are now being revealed. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't really have any direct questions, but like you, I have those concerns and observations, and I'm not sure that there's going to be a quick fix unless there's a complete change in the skills and direction of the executive at the UIF and the Compensation Commissioner. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Honorable Lees. Honorable Dolashe.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson and Honorable Members. Honorable Chairperson, let me take this opportunity to welcome the presentation both from SIU and AG. Thank you very much. Chairperson, mine is not so big. However, I really want to assure these SIU and AG that we are behind them 24/7 in making sure that we achieve what the president announced to really make sure that we deal with anybody who is involved in these corrupt tendencies. Doesn't matter whose name the person is, where the person comes from. I really would want to recommit to say they must. I'm also quite impressed with the kind of work that is being done, Chair, especially by AG. Within a very short space of time, they've been able to produce these reports. This Chair is unprecedented. Yes. We appreciate them. Chair, from the SIU, once again, they always impress me as well. I just want them to explain to me when they said there's double dipping. What does that mean? Chair, about UIF, it's like somebody knew that we are going to be hit by COVID-19. When you listen to how there are no systems in UIF. It's like they knew that there would be this kind of a pandemic. Hence, I'm saying, Chair, anybody and everybody who took advantage of this cage must be brought to book. I've never heard of these kind of weaknesses in the UIF systems. It's never heard of where you cannot have a system to check whether a person is in fact having a valid ID. When a person can just, as a student, being able to draw from UAF, it's like it was deliberate. But I really wouldn't want to be emotional about it, but I want to celebrate these two institutions, but also to hear more from SIU when they talk double dipping. Exactly what do they mean? Do they mean a student in NSFAS as well as getting some grant? Is that what they mean? I just want to hear that. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Mam Dulashe Babusomia.
Members, thank you very much for the two reports, one from the SIU and the other from the Auditor General. We are sucking the blood out of him before he exits the system. I think indeed for the AG, for his consistency around the work and the commitment to serve the nation, we really need to appreciate that. And on his way out, his preparedness to share some of those outstanding instances in terms of his engagement. Thanks, AG. So I'm looking into the various slides on the original report of the Auditor General. Well, very interesting sites go to the analysis which they have made on the UIF, taking into account on the received applications and how those applications are finalized. So my interest is going to be there, which deal with those numbers of claims. For example, there's a slide on your original report as tabled, which starts with an indication of the number of days which are taken before payments are made. That slide is somewhat in page 39 of your original report, the main report, it indicates that the applications which are 30 days old at the time of the audit were a little bit above 6 million of those applications, indicatively that such applications would be attended beyond a 30-day period. And there were applications between 30 days and 60 days old, which are about 11,000. And there were applications which were somewhat a bit trickier for me. The date of processing is the same with the date of application. You see, it was about 202,311. What is striking is that looking into such a kind of an occurrence, you begin to ask yourself as to what does this whole thing mean? You see that here you are, you are sitting with a number of applications. Those number of applications are somewhat looked into in the variance of time, and the benefits are somewhat paid outright. And as such, you would look into the quantum that application carries. For example, the same day payment, same day application goes beyond 1 billion rands. So for me, the speed of carrying this task, and at the same time, the less speed of carrying this task begins to carry some questions as to what is a causal factor for us to see this kind of a behavior in as far as the systems that UIF carries, both for application and for payments, for them to be able to achieve this kind of a questionable way of dealing with their own work. The second area is the area which I thought is going to somewhat affirm one of the points that the AG emphasizes overall in his audit report, that government carries multiplicity of systems which are not talking to each other, and therefore exposing the fiscus more towards a risk than it would have been if there had been some kind of consolidation in as far as such systems are concerned. I really don't know as to when such a finding is made on a prolonged process of execution, whether are we going to see any level of a drastic change in terms of processing some kind of transactions which is going to improve the level of risk which is associated with such a kind of systems. I see that SIU has been forced to write to various departments or entities for verification of some of the information that they are seeking to clarify on their own investigations. And indeed, it then confirms what the AG has found out, that you have to take a longer route to determine the justiceness of whatever process that has been undertaken, and the tools and instruments used to somewhat evaluate and value the contribution around such a tool or instrument, one way or the other. And Chair, this might be something which should not necessarily be carried by the audit itself or the SIU. It's something which goes back to those who carry the service, who are supposed to take the service forward in terms of benefit to those who are awaiting to be served as such, whether they are talking about UIF, whether they are talking about SASA, whether they are talking about NSFAS. As long as you carry that kind of a deficiency, the risks multiply in terms of the issuance of the IDs, in terms of using such IDs, in terms of verification of such identities, and looking into the actual permissions, as it is the case in terms of a heavy migrant scenario in the South African social environment, looking into those who are foreign nationals benefiting into the system, and the system which does not carry that kind of interaction in as far as assessing the actual physical nature of benefit of such individuals, which carries that danger. So those are the a few areas which I wanted to comment on, Chair. The other one would be carried by the department or the UIF itself in terms of the benefit claims received per sector, because if you stretch the two largest sectors which are exposed on the benefit lines at 29% and 25.8% in terms of the benefits at the time of the audit. One goes to personal services and the other goes to trade. And if you have to take those two slides together, in fact, in terms of the graphic presentation, you would question where then is our economic benefit lies, and whether is this true reflection of where the economy lies, and looking into the actual benefit and the employees which are involved in those sectors, and looking at the quantum of benefit as outlined by the AG. Thank you very much, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Somya. Can we go to Honourable Hadebe and then HOU and AG, you can then give us.
No, thank you so much, Honourable Chair. Let me follow suit in welcoming reports presented. I will not spoil the good messages from the leadership in thanking the AG. Chair, these reports, they really make us very disturbed, Chair. I don't have much to say in terms of the report because much of the work is still in progress. And tomorrow, we'll be going to the headquarters of UIF and we'll make sure that we do not leave any stone unturned in exposing these vultures. Chair, with the levels of unemployment, inequalities, and poverty in our country, it's very disturbing, Chair, to learn that you still have 6,140 civil servants, state employees, defrauding the very same state that put bread on their table to a tune which is approximately 41 million. Chair, we are also not respecting the death. You have individuals, 68 claims from a deceased individual to a tune of 441,000, Chair. This is very disturbing and shocking. 7 inmates in orange overalls, Chair, while serving your sentence. Someone is claiming on your behalf relief while you are in jail to a tune of 40,000 rand, Chair. I am lost for words when you also have SASA beneficiaries. SASA benefits an NSFAS student. Not so long ago, we had Fees Must Fall, free education. You still have NSFAS students, SASA beneficiaries. I understand this argument about no law prohibiting them from claiming, but here we're talking about South Africa, which is faced with a high level of unemployment. Where are the morals? Where are the ethics? Where are the values of us as South Africans when you're going to double dip in times of crisis? Chair, while SANDF was busy scoping and donoring our people in townships, you have some amongst them with multiple accounts claiming relief from the very same fund. What happened to this country? What went wrong with our Rainbow Nation and Ubuntu, Chair? You have underage child labor. We were told that there were underage individuals also claiming the funds. Chair, angazi ukuthi kwakhala nyoni emzansi. Ngempela ngiphelelwe amazwi, ngikhathazekile, ngidumele. Hence, I cannot wait for us to go to our oversight, to tomorrow in Pretoria, the UIF headquarters. These culprits must be brought to book. We're not going to leave any stone unturned in getting to the bottom of this. We cannot have, this is no longer about politics and corruption. These are civil servants. The country and the nation, we need to stand up and put an end to this. Thank you, SIU. Thank you, AG, for doing a sterling work. Ngiyabonga,
Sla. All right. Colleagues, I think really all of us, as HOU and AG, you can hear, not surprised at all of this, given the fact that we have pointed to these things before. But I think the biggest indictment, of course, is whilst there are shortcomings in the system, you also have got people generally in the citizenry who are unafraid to take chances to exploit those vulnerabilities. And therefore, that speaks generally to now a corrupt society. And so those are all things we really have to look at. And I think it is incumbent on leadership to begin a process of, whilst on one hand self-reflecting, but on national reflection about how, whilst we lament public service corruption, in one way or the other, we are gravitating to a citizen that is jumping onto that bandwagon. I think that compounds our problem even further. And this does not in any way exonerate officials on the corruption which they have participated in, aided and abetted and engineered with the primary reason to loot the state. I want to just HOU get in further unpacking on the 78 soldiers, SANDF officials, just the set of circumstances around that. And I think from our research team, if questions can begin to be crafted to the SANDF itself on those individuals, so we can get a full picture of the set of circumstances as to why they were on the system and why they're beneficiaries. So I think, HOU, if you can just unpack for us that, because increasingly every interaction we're having, one or the other, is exposing some serious shortcomings in the SANDF. And it obviously has to become a focus area. All right, I'm going to hand over to the HOU and the AG for responses, and they will delegate as they deem fit in the teams that they have brought along with them. Over to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. We appreciate the comments, and we will really make it our duty that we carry those forward in terms of holding those who are responsible for all of these irregularities and corrupt activities, that they are held to account, and the monies that have been lost should be traced and recovered back to the state. As I indicated, that generally the observation is that there has been a failure of people, process and systems, and both presentations really talk to that. From the people side, one would observe that either there has been a measure of collusion, fraudulent activities that ultimately result into this corrupt activities. From a process perspective, is that processes were clearly just deliberately overlooked or just circumvented for purposes of paying out these monies fraudulently. The system is very clear from all the presentations, in particular the AG presentation, that the system, there was a lot of system failure, but of course there's a mixture of system failure and people, where people deliberately circumvent the system so that this fraudulent and corrupt payments can be made. So in that regard, we will have to determine from an investigation perspective whether there has been all of these factors. Are they interlinked to an extent of committing these offences? So, Chair, I'd like to just really appreciate Honourable Lee's comments in terms of lack of proper systems, professionalism from various areas of UIF, call centre and the others. And as we investigate further, we'll really dive deep into those shortcomings. Honourable Tolashe, thank you again for the comments. The term double dipping really simplistically means that you are unfairly or unlawfully getting benefits from two sources of funds. So in a sense, it means that having looked at the people involved, we found that they've obtained income from two different sources. And of course, typically this would be in an illicit manner. And if I make an example, if you talk about SANDF officials or any government official, he would be employed by government, but during the time when this test was declared, this was meant to alleviate the issues that were caused by unemployment that would have resulted as a result of the other COVID-19 related issues. So those who remained employed, they did not really experience the hardship like those who lost employment. So in a sense, it meant that those who continued to be employed could not go and obtain funds or any payment or benefits from the UIF or TERS in particular. So if you were employed, you were to use the term dipping or being paid from the salary, but you also went now illicitly, unlawfully, corruptly to go and benefit from the UIF. So that is the double part, right? So we are saying we have found those instances, and those instances should be punished. The investigation should now dive deep and say, you know, the extent to which a certain individual benefited, how did he or she benefit? Did he work with anybody? Did he collude with anyone internal to UIF? So the investigation will take that out. And ultimately, of course, we would need to get those monies paid back. So that's really how high level I can really explain the double dipping part. As you could see, the language is also used in the Auditor General's presentation, but that's high level how I can explain it. And indeed, Honorable Somio, we will really make sure that all those who are involved in all of this irregular, corrupt activities, we point them out, and they should be punished accordingly. As we indicated in our presentation, we are monitoring the criminal cases that have been opened, and we will monitor them to conclusion, just so that that we mete out the appropriate criminal sanctions to those who have been arrested. I'm going to pause here, Chair, and thanks again for the Chair's comments. Where there are shortcomings in the system, it all speaks to the general society of corruption. We agree with that. That is really something
as society that we really, really need to address. And I think going forward, we look forward to the National Anti-Corruption Strategy being signed off ultimately and being rolled out and galvanizing the society on an ongoing basis to make sure that this culture is really dealt with. So we look forward to that. Chair, I will hand over to my colleague, Mr. Lepeto, who will unpack this issue around the SANDF officials and the nature of the findings there. Mr. Lepeto, if you can just explain that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate. I'm going to, with your permission, just do it okay. On behalf of Mr. Lepeto. Thank you.
That's fine.
Thank you. So as we illustrated, Chair and the rest of the members, on slide 28 of our presentation, we made it clear that we have submitted requests to the various government departments for further information. So our information, as we analyzed the data from the AGSA, illustrated the 78 SANDF individuals with their ID numbers and so forth, and then appears to have been receiving benefits from the TERS. So as part of our investigation, we would then approach the employer, in this case the SANDF, to give us more details for the SIU to be 100% certain that we are indeed dealing with individuals that are currently still employed and that there are no further anomalies that we need to go and determine. So the spreadsheet sent with the letter was an extract from the data from the AGSA, and that would then include the personal numbers of the individuals, the ID numbers, and the request to them was then confirmed that these individuals are in fact employed. Are they currently employed? What is their position, salary levels, and et cetera. And then once we have that information, which would be available to the SIU this week, we would then approach the matter going forward in terms of approaching the SANDF officials and verifying the information received, and we'll take the step from there in terms of bringing them to book, either disciplining them, registering criminal cases if there was indeed information pointing to an offence committed, and that would also be going back to the UIF, drawing the records from there, verifying that that information was indeed presented by that individual, and that would then amount to the SIU registering criminal cases and would then monitor those cases going forward. I thank you, Chair, and I thank you, Head of the Unit.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Well, I just made a point that my colleague made. Once we receive that information from those various state institutions, we will now sort of analyze further and then just check the level of collusion that has been made. The point made by Honorable Hadebe around this underage people, we really don't have the exact age, but it would be interesting really to just determine, you know, the underage, and if somebody was below the transacting age, then it means there has been somebody who's assisting this person, and that really becomes a very worrying factor. But we will also look at that. Chair, I will pause here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you very much to the HOU and his team. Bob Margaret, AG, and your team, over to you.
Once again, thank you, Chair. Let me maybe just pay attention to the issues that Honorable Somio raised, particularly on the page 39 that table that Honorable Somio you referred to is a very perfect example of what happens when we have not put our control measures in place. Just thinking about some application, for example, you mentioned in that table, certain application dates for the benefit of the UIF CARES were the same as payment date. And others, the application date was after the payment date. And those amounts are quite big. And no wonder the findings that we have made, because what it tells us is that not much work has been done to verify the information that has been put on the application. If on the day you receive it, you are already in a position to pay something like 1.1 billion on that same day. It means that the verification processes as well as the validation controls that need to be put in place are unlikely to be done in the same day for such a volume of transactions. It therefore highlights the risk that the basis for these deficiencies was also to do with the fact that there was not sufficient time taken or invested by the people who were processing these transactions at the UIF to satisfy themselves that indeed, when they press the send button for the money to be paid, they are all happy about the detail as well as the parameters within which the payment is being made. You can take it a bit further, Chair, and say, in an electronic processing environment, there are many people who remain invisible to a lot of us. They could be here in the country, they could be operating from somewhere else. If the controls in the information systems environment are not strong, those people also have the capability to illicitly obtain ID numbers of various people, submit applications purporting to be those individuals, and if a fund does not have the requisite control processes to check, the chances are that you might pay those people without having been any wiser. And people who target information systems environments do that. You'll recall recently, during the time that we were in lockdown, one of the companies that keep our credit information was hacked into. So everybody who has got their name on that database, their ID number appears alongside their name. And I think one of the things we need to start thinking about is that as we go into the future, there are many departments and state organs and agencies that are going to commit to doing things in the electronic environment. But the reality of the situation is that in the electronic environment, we are not there all by ourselves. There are other people who are piggybacking on us who we do not know, nor do we know their intentions. Hence the need for some of these preventative controls to be loaded on the electronic environment, Chair. I often think about my experience at the ATM. If the ATM, Chair, allowed for me to put something in an envelope and I purport this particular thing in an envelope to be a check which I'm depositing into my account, and I do it in a shopping mall at the ATM where I slip in the envelope and I say there's 5,000 rands in that envelope. If the bank did not have preventative controls and I come back 3 minutes later to withdraw against that 5,000 rands, I'm sure most banks would have been bankrupt by now. And the reason that they are not is because when you do that deposit, the bank has got a system in place which says that wait for whatever number of days before these funds are cleared as deposited. credited into your account after we have satisfied ourselves as the bank that that envelope that you deposited on Sunday afternoon is indeed valid money. Another thing is what is going to need to be addressed on an ongoing basis when it comes to processing transactions in an electronic environment. Otherwise, anyone who's running out of money can easily pick up a piece of paper, put it in an envelope, make it sound like it's a deposit to their account, withdraw it and leave the country without anyone tracing them afterwards. So that to me, Chair, is one of the things that we need to begin to look at and say, how do we, from an oversight point of view, assist in fortifying the environments where huge amounts of money are processed in government? Because some of them can lend themselves easily to a proactive audit. Others, which are like infrastructure layout and delivery, may not necessarily respond to a proactive, timely audit as compared to other transactions like UIF and SASA benefits and all of that. So I think, Jay, as we ponder the future and looking at the kind of volumes of transactions that we have to pay to third parties, to what extent do we have the requisite security in our systems environment? To what extent do we have reliable application controls? Application controls being those controls that enable us to know if there is an exception to some of the rules that we have written in the electronic systems that process our transactions. So I think, Chair, that table on page 39, from my point of view, is quite a telling example of what would happen generally if there's no evidence of time being taken to analyze, to review, and to validate transactions. And I hope that that will assist in amplifying the points that Honorable Somio raised earlier on. As far as the double dipping side of things is concerned, Chair, I confirm that the English dictionary that Advocate Andy Mutibi reads from is the same as the one that we also read from. So what he has said is exactly how we have understood this. Because other people know government is not strong in some areas of control based on past audit outcomes. So they normally do what others do, throw the bait and hope that we are only going to get fish. However, in most instances, we have seen that some throw the bait hoping that nobody is going to check. If it goes through, then you can rest assured that they will submit even bigger claims in subsequent periods. And so, Chair, the vulnerabilities are not going to end now. It's just that we were in a situation where it was urgent for us to look at it from a multidisciplinary point of view. And we think that that has assisted in making sure that even as the UIF was reporting, I think last week, they were making some assertions to the fact that they have already recovered in the order of somewhere between 3.5 and 4.3 billion rands of some of the monies that they paid in appropriately to some of the companies that they were interacting with. So we didn't share that. That's to us one of the key areas we need to look out for here while the orange overalls and other things are happening. But if we fortify our systems properly and we monitor them through the accounting officers, we can eliminate the bulk of what we are confronted with here. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, no, thank you very much, AG, HOU. I think, colleagues, we can bring it to an end, really. This was to brief us and empower us and enable us to have the fundamental perspectives insofar as our oversight visit to the UIF on Friday is concerned. And I think we have been able to go through all the salient points which are necessary for us to engage meaningfully with the department and, of course, the entity. But what is fundamentally key is that corruption has characterized some of the operations at the UIF and consequence management, of course, will follow as and when these investigations are concluded. Hopefully, there will be successful prosecutions and recoveries for the state. But also, I think at the same time, particularly just around the issues of the SANDF, if it is found that those soldiers or officials of the SANDF were complicit in aiding and abetting the corruption, they should be dismissals. We cannot have a situation whereby people who continue to be on the payroll of the state then loot the state, much to the detriment of those who are in dire economic straits as they push back on the frontiers of COVID-19 from an unemployment perspective. And so that's how far these things need to go. They have to be dismissals, and I think that we'll be following up on that matter very, very seriously insofar as those areas are concerned. Mm-hmm. Secondly, colleagues, I think it is increasingly becoming necessary, as pointed out in the past, that the reports of the SIU go to the presidency. I will crave and beg your indulgence that we look for a date in our already packed program so that the presidency can take us on board in terms of the implementation of the recommendations which the SIU may have had and how they are responding to the findings of the SIU and of course the special audits that are going on, because if this thing piles up to the extent to which it becomes a lot, and some of the things will fall through the cracks, and we are going to lose sight of the very, very real challenges. So I think it will be in the best interest of full-scale oversight on our part to bring it full circle and actually now invite the presidency on those very key areas insofar as COVID-19 expenditure is concerned. So I think, colleagues, as I indicated, we came into this meeting knowing this and that their systems are not up to date and that they are vulnerable and prone to abuse and corruption. And what we have heard today from both the SIU and the AG confirms that. And so we well within our rights to have actually decided that we would want to go and interact with the UIF at that point. I'm told that I may have conveyed my thank you message to the AG early, and some people may not have heard it. I'm not going to repeat it. Safe to say, AG, once again, thank you very much. And maybe, hopefully, before you step down at the end of November, you would have had another opportunity to engage with us. But in the event that we don't meet, I do want to borrow the words of one poet who says, and I quote, "May the road rise up to meet you, may the wind be ever at your back, and may the sun shine warm upon your face, and may the rain fall softly on your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the hollow of his hand." So with that, we wish you well for your future endeavors. And once again, we want to say thank you for the very healthy relationship that we have had. And I do believe that our paths will cross again, as I know you will not be lost to the country, as all you have ever been is a patriot. And so I believe that all that will be what characterizes your outlook moving forward. Once again, Mam Tolasha, we want to thank you and your team, your ad hoc committee, for a job well done. I think whilst it was an ad hoc committee, the knowledge that you were a member of SCOPA was clear, the manner in which you handled that entire process. So sibonga kakhulu. Colleagues, we can bring it to an end at that. We will meet at the UIF on Friday. Sithombi and Butben and Lungisa will be communicating with the members who will be attending that oversight. I will request the AG and HOU that officials from your office be made available to us on Friday for ease of reference and cross-checking and fact-checking as and when we interact and engage with the UIF and the Department of Employment and Labour. I think this is one of the most important oversights we will undertake during this time of COVID-19, just given the gravity of the situation which continues to confront us and the risks of irresponsible behavior, which may fast track the second wave. And whilst a lockdown is not on the cards yet, insofar as going back to level 3, 4, or 5, but I think the warning must go out to South Africans that we're not out of the woods. And if we behave in a reckless manner, we are putting ourselves at risk, not just health-wise, but economically as well. I think if we are serious about coming out of this, let us exercise that behavior, because we don't want a situation whereby further jobs are going to be lost as we probably risk going back to another lockdown. So those are all the considerations we have to make. And I think from a public accounts perspective, it's quite clear that the public purse is already far stretched beyond its limits. And so every effort needs to be done to protect the public purse, but also at the same time, we will get back into jobs and generate taxes so that we can be able to meet the competing priorities. So I think that message does need to go out, that let us be responsible. Wear a mask, social distance, sanitize, and let's not be reckless and irresponsible. Particularly, Peggy and I, as young people, let us tell the other young people this open-ended partying and clubbing. Guys, no. Let us not buy. And put ourselves at risk. Babu Dex, good to see you. Sibonga Kulu. All right, colleagues, on that note, let us meet on Friday at the UIF offices in Pretoria. HOU and your team from the SIU, thank you. AG and your team, thank you very much. And colleagues and to our staff.
Thank you. Thank you.
Clock for the MTPBES.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you. Yes, indeed.